time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 16th of June 2012. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by the Humble Pie Village Butchery. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Oneroa. On Saturday the 16th of June, Sharon Brown talked to Graham Orr, president of the Waiheke Golf Club, along with Paul Walden, horse rider and local board member. And then she spoke with the runner-up of MasterChef, Anna Schwartz.
Right, hello again. Okay, well, we've got Graham Orr, president of the golf club, and Paul Walden, a community board member and also rider. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Good morning.
Brendan Graham.
Great. Okay, well, look, so it's been a big week, hasn't it, for the golf course and what's been happening there. So can you just explain, because I wasn't very clear. So there was a tournament planned, was it last Saturday? Or last Sunday?
The O'Hara Golf Club came up from Taranaki. It was 20 or 30 of them. It wasn't so much a tournament as that they were just invited in to play with our haggle, which they did.
Lovely. And so there were hooves across the golf course?
Yes, there was.
And then you guys did a sterling job of patching it up before they could play?
Yeah, our volunteer forces, which have been doing a massive job anyway. Fixed it up sufficiently so that it could be played upon. It was a bit rough, but putting's hard enough as it is without putting through horse hooves, but they managed.
Right. Okay. Yes. And then there were these horse hooves across the golf course. So it's quite interesting because when you look in the paper, I'm not a rider and I'm not a golfer. But one of the things that's really striking is is a lot of the letters that have come from golfers have really insisted that it's been malicious, that there's been some sort of foul play. Why do you think that's come about?
Well, for all intents and purposes, when I went and had a look at it, it did look malicious. The trail of the horse was horse or horses. But I believe it was only one, went from green to green in a direct line. And it just from the look of it, it looked like, the greens had been targeted.
Right, okay. Did you have any, because there have been some new developments on that. Are you both aware of that, Paul?
Yeah, absolutely. And I just think for clarity for Graham and the golfing community, certainly the equestrian community and the riding club are quite distressed about this whole incident. And just by way of understanding, as I've explained to a number of people over the past week, you're looking at this thing from the trying to get into the mindset of a horse. We've got a series of large tree-lined corridors which have at the end of them a green round piece of grass, which we know is something that's carefully manicured and valuable and something that should be protected. The horse doesn't have that same perception, and so in this instance it's a horse that's been running loose at dusk, at night time, and it's galloping, or moving at speed between this tree-lined corridor. So I certainly, looking at it from that perspective, you can see there's two greens in particular which have been crossed over on more than one occasion, and in both of those situations the greens are surrounded on three sides by wetland, and you can see where the horse has run down towards the wetland, turned around, run back across the green, hit the wetland again and then run out, and then across a causeway or a carriageway across the wetland and onto the next part of the course and down this lovely tree-lined corridor. So I think looking at it in that perspective and the horse riding club, who are the neighbours, have as soon as they could get in touch with Graham, offered to contribute towards the remediation of the damage. As neighbours, we certainly have been through a difficult time over the past 10 years with the district plan review. And I guess bearing all of that into consideration, that was the most distressing part of this exercise.
But how often does this happen, that a horse gets away and trashes any kind of property? I mean, I've been on the island for 10 years. Is that a regular occurrence? Because it doesn't seem to make it into the papers very often.
Yeah, well, that's right. And I've grown up in this valley. My family own a large landholding. They're probably the largest landowners in Onitangi Village these days. We used to farm 400 sheep adjacent to the golf course. And I have to say that stock getting out isn't uncommon. I'm aware of at least three other incidents in the last year and a half where there's been horses across the golf course, across the greens in particular, and in every situation the rider's been down there and the issue's been dealt with at the time. I can understand, and I get the hysteria with this, I can understand members of the golf club turning up on a Saturday morning, seeing this damage and jumping to the conclusion. I get that.
Mm. Why willful damage, though? I mean, I don't really know. I mean, I know a couple of riders, and they just seem like incredibly gentle people. Why was the conclusion jumped to that it would be willful damage? I mean, there were five or six letters insisting that, you know, justice needed to be done. I mean, I can quote from the letters: shocked by this vandalism. This was an act of vandalism. You know, it just goes, there's just lots and lots of references to it in all these letters. This travesty, it became very apparent that the damage was intentional. It was intended to provoke a reaction for some unknown reason from members and staff of the golf club. Where's that come from?
Yeah, well, those are individuals, and I can't I can't answer for individuals. You know, I mean, I'd just like to assure everybody and you, Paul, that we have not discounted the theory of runaway horse at all. It looked very unlikely to us as lay people. You know, I mean, my thought, if a horse got loose on a beautiful, lush piece of field that the golf course is, that it would think it was in heaven and graze on the lush grass, of which there's plenty. I'm sure many golfers can attest to that. And the likelihood that the horse would go from green to green to green, where I would have thought would make very poor grazing, just seemed very unlikely. But, you know, the letters to the editor, I mean, those are just individuals, and, you know, I mean, there's no way in the world in this forum that I can answer for those, and don't intend to. I mean, the golf course's take on it is that, you know, our main priority now is how do we fix this?
Mm.
I mean, it's not a witch hunt. It's never been a witch hunt, and I spoke with Martin at the Golf News and made that very clear, I thought, that this was not a witch hunt.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, moving into the future, there is a bridle track around the golf course. It seems to me, I mean, I've only walked down there, but it seems that it's quite a nice place to walk. There are some shady trees. If you're walking across from the sports park around that area, it adds to somewhere else that walkers can use. The golf club is there. It's obviously, you know, as a horse rider, it would be nice not to have to walk along the road and to be able to cut around the side of the golf course. Do you have a problem with riders? I mean, here it says that negotiations with the riding club would be impossible, and we feel that sharing our course with horse riders is clearly counterproductive to providing a much-loved and well-used facility of which the island can be proud. But they're not walking; they're not going across the green, they're going round the green, so isn't there a space for riders there?
Well, I mean, the reason that we're here is that they went across the green.
But it wasn't a horse and a rider, it was a runaway horse, which apparently doesn't happen very often.
That's not been conclusively proven, though, has it?
Okay, so you still feel that there was some sort of willful damage?
Like anything, I mean, in any situation, you've got to consider all possibilities, you know? And we have not discounted the runaway horse. I just feel, you know, because the lines from one green to another were so direct, it got an angry reaction from people.
Although, having said that, you said you don't really know very much about riding. And, Paul, did you not say that... I mean, it sounds to me like the horse was quite distressed and was trying to get... I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't suggest the horse is distressed, and I just make the observation that horses, like people, their life doesn't revolve around just eating, and they do have recreational desires. You know, a horse in the wild will travel up to 100 kilometres a day. This is a difficult time of year for grazing. Horses are penned up in small paddocks all over the island, often behind little electric fences. This is a young horse. It's a four-year-old. It's broken out of its tiny wee paddock that it's been in for some time, and it's gone for a really nice run. And that's some perspective there. As to the whole notion that there's some willful intent here, and even the denial of a witch hunt, it's disappointing. But I think at this stage, it's unfortunate that we're all in this position. I certainly feel that there has been some intent of a witch hunt here. And it's been somewhat distressing that even at this stage in the week, we haven't actually been able to get to the bottom of it. We've managed to have the police, golf club committee members, members of the local board, all finding their way down there on Saturday morning for a photo shoot. And yet here we are a week later, no one's actually managed to follow the hoof prints across the road, as I did yesterday with the Golf News journalist Martin, all the way back to the paddock where last weekend we were explaining the horse most likely came from.
Mm. And can you explain why the local board member was in the paper with the police on the golf course? I mean, I just thought it was quite a lot of people felt that was quite a strange thing, that there was this sort of photo op with people sort of saying that there was, her comments in the paper also suggest that it was some sort of willful damage.
That's her opinion. She was interested. She wanted to have a look. She feels that it's her community duty, and that's what she did.
Right. Okay. Okay. So I know that, is it Hagley Park, or there's some park somewhere where horses and golfers exist side by side in quite a happy arrangement.
Yeah. There's some parks all around the world. There's a series in Auckland. If you get off, so not specifically talking about horses in this instance, but if you get off the car ferry and drive up to Music Point at the end of the Tamaki River, there's the golf course there that's got walking tracks and a road right through the middle of it. The Awhitu Regional Park, which is a council-owned park in South Auckland's got a bridle trail that crosses directly through the middle of five fairways. As part of our district plan process, we've got statements there from the ranger, the senior ranger for the regional park, saying there's never in the entire history of that park been any issue of conflict between equestrians and riders. We presented an argument and some evidence from Pebble Beach in California, which is a classic one. There's 30 kilometres of bridle trails there that wind through seven different golf courses, which hosted the 2010 US Open. This isn't an uncommon thing. Even statistically, for equestrians, there's quite a close relationship nationally with golf. The second sport for equestrians is golf. And this is reflected by the Sports and Recreation Council figures. So, essentially we're looking at shared recreational use on rural property, and it's unfortunate in this situation. And I think this is a failure on behalf of the council. It's what we've maintained for a long time, and it's really distressing for me, having grown up in this community, and seeing this feud, which has been ongoing for 30-odd years over the use of this land. The reality is it is a community-owned park. It's administered by the council. The council has an obligation to provide for the recreational needs of the community. That's why the park was purchased. At the time it was purchased in 1983, it was owned by a private development company. At that stage, the golf course, the club, were paying a heavy lease to the tune of $10,000 a year, and they couldn't afford to pay it. The community rallied together, including my family, and encouraged the council to buy this block of land with the encouragement of the golf club to preserve the nine-hole golf course. It was bought on the understanding, in writing by the golf club of the day, and at the insistence of councillors, that it would remain a nine-hole golf course and the remaining land would be used for other recreational activities. Some of them were at the time identified as immediately required, specifically detailed, including pony trails, which were put on the maps immediately after that and have existed around the circumference of the golf course throughout the entire life of the park. So we're in this, having this conversation today, not at all to do with a genuine any willful intent, but an ambition by a minority development lobby within the golf club. It's my understanding that it's not the general intent of the golf club to expand to 18 holes, but there is a development lobby that would like to. And so what's happened in the past 5 years is there is a series of expansions that have taken place on the golf course, and these have expanded the golf course to the outside periphery of the bridle trails, and this has created a conflict, or a perceived conflict. But in saying that, I don't believe there is any genuine conflict, and even if the council were to conduct a reserve management plan and get to the end of this process and develop an 18-hole golf course, based on what happens throughout the world and the willful the working, wanting to get on as good neighbours desire within the equestrian community and the Waiheke community, I just don't see why we can't have an 18-hole golf course or develop this park as the community requires and still share this space.
I hear what you're saying, Paul. I unfortunately am not entirely agreeing with you, but you know, we get that.
So what do you disagree on?
I just feel that horses and golf don't mix. I mean, the incident of last Saturday morning does tend to underline that.
Yes, but the incident last Saturday morning seems to have been one runaway horse, of which there are not many, from what I can gather over the years, and that could have been anyone's property. It happened to be the golf course.
Yeah, previously it's been sheep and cows too. It's not, you know, we're not just talking about horses. Personally, I've chased sheep and cows off that golf course over the years.
And also, do people, I mean, looking at the hoof prints, it was obviously very, very wet land. Mm. So don't people cause damage if there's a whole group of people traipsing across the golf course? Do they not create a big muddy patch?
We've got some fatties in our golf club, but not many of them weigh 300 kilograms, fortunately.
But still, if you get 30 people going across it, or you get greater use of the golf course on a wet, rainy day, then presumably you also get some sort of damage.
One of the suggestions that we've put to the golf club and the council over the years is that it would be in the interests, I believe, of the golf club and the equestrian community and the community in general to actually develop and construct a reasonable standard trail around the park, which would enable the golfers to continue using their golf buggies throughout the wettest times of the year. And it could also be an easily demarked, obviously bridle trail and walking cycling trail, whatever else, that was actually deliberately designed in such a fashion as to not to cause any or minimum disruption to the game. And I have to say, from having ridden around this park throughout my life, that 99% of the time, the interaction between the golfing community and the equestrian community is a really positive reaction. It's really exciting at times to find golfers that are visiting the island from Auckland that stop and pat the horses and want to have their photos taken, and find that a really exciting and something really special to actually be able to pat a horse on the golf course. It's, you know, this has the potential to be something beautiful and something specially Waiheke.
I think it's a shame that there isn't more conciliatory behaviour around this whole issue, because I think you've got these huge tracts of land, and as we move into the future, we can't just say, okay, well, this area is going to be for horses, this area is going to be for golfers, in a sense, we all need to share the recreational space. And it doesn't, I mean, I can understand that maybe, someone gets bonked on the head, or maybe there's, one in 5,000 balls happens to frighten a horse or something. But, a car frightens a horse, and it's much more dangerous for them to be on the road than to be in a park.
I'll take you, Sharon, and we'll have this conversation briefly in relation to Hagley Park. My wife and I visited Hagley Park about 5 years ago now and met with the golf club down there. Hagley Park's a large park and smack bang in the middle of Christchurch City, and located in this park is either a 9 or 11 hole golf course, which has got walking trails that run throughout the golf course. The golf course has been designed in such a fashion to accommodate this, and there is literally thousands and thousands of people. In fact, on any Saturday morning, as quoted by the golf club, there's up to 15,000 people playing sports directly adjacent to the golf course. And the golf course is, you know, the requirement of the council and the community is that it wasn't fenced. They didn't want to be looking at unsightly fences. They didn't want to be looking at trees that were blocking out the views across the reserve. So, you know, so the whole thing has been designed in such a fashion to really make it a community-owned facility. There's a greater level of maintenance that the council takes in that reserve, and they certainly help with cutting the grass, and that's something I'd love to see happen on Waiheke. It would be just, I think, wonderful to see the Waiheke golf course become a more of a community golf course. I'd love to see the council easing the burden on the golf club. It's an expensive activity, playing golf and maintaining all that land, and I think it would be wonderful if there is a relationship similar to what we see with the soccer fields or the tennis courts, where the council's maintaining the infrastructure, the golf club are able to run their tournaments midweek and on the weekends, but the whole thing is more affordable for the community. Mm. One of the concerns that I have with the proposed development to 18 holes is just the cost of this. You know, firstly, we're looking at a multi-million dollar development, but secondly, the suggestion, as outlined by the golf club in their development proposal, is that the green fees are likely to increase from around $500 a year up to $1,500 a year. And when we have a mean income on Waiheke of less than $18,000 a year, I ask myself how many people in this community are going to be able to play golf on this recreation reserve.
Mm. And I think that's also a shared space, isn't it? From what I understand, the museum, the horses and the golf club, or the riding club and the golf club, all share that space. So for me, I struggle a little bit with this thing of like use it or lose it. So somehow, you know, we're going to have an 18-hole golf course, and there doesn't seem to be a willingness to share that with riders or pedestrians or other possible users of that. And then there might be things in the future, once there is this sort of resource management plan, that we think, well, actually the our community would benefit from something else, but now we can't because we've got an 18-hole golf course there.
Mm. At the time this park was purchased in 1984, the council conducted, this was a significant expense for the community. It was as I recall from talking to councillors of the day, it dried up all the funds that were in the council kitty. They conducted a recreation needs assessment for the island, and they specifically identified that, and part of that assessment was looking at land that was available on Western Waiheke for recreational space. And this side of the Awa Awa Valley, there isn't an abundance of flat land, and they identified that this was the only land on Western Waiheke that was available for future recreational development. And it was on that basis, and it's clearly documented, that it was purchased. And I'll quote from the report of the day. The site is of easy contour, is centrally located. The present 9-hole golf course, which would remain, occupies approximately half of the site, and with a minimal amount of earthworks, there'd be room for at least 3 full-size football fields, hockey and soccer fields on the remaining land. In addition, there'd also be room for a variety of other activities, such as lawn bowls, rifle range, archery, BMX, pony tracks, athletics, cross-country tracks, etc.
Can I just ask, if the 18 holes go ahead, is that a permanent change, or is, if another use is found for it, that would be reversed, or what is the situation with the 18 holes?
This is another subject altogether, and we could be here all day talking about that, and I'm not equipped to make comments on that because I haven't done the research on, you know, and I personally think the 18 holes has its difficulties, and you'd have to have your head in the sand not to think that. But let's not lose perspective of what this discussion is about. And Paul talked of disappointment about denial of witch hunts and things. But, you know, can you imagine when I took over the presidency last year, we were in deep financial trouble, and we had to let our greenkeepers go. One of them stayed on a voluntary basis, and we call him Sir Cliff. He's done a fantastic amount of job. The volunteers have done an amazing amount of work, just, you know, well beyond the call of duty. We at the golf club felt this heart-sinking disappointment when that hard work had been basically ruined.
I think everyone understands that. Yeah. I mean, I think we're all really... I mean, I personally was really sympathetic, not that I play golf, but, I mean, it must be really tragic, especially when you've got people coming from off-island who've made the trip over, and then you look at these beautiful greens. I mean, you know, it is a really, really tragic thing, but I think it was more the fact that it was just targeted at the riding club and seen as being malicious, that as someone from the public, and I share this view with a lot of people I've spoken to, it's like, what is going on? Honestly, all these letters from the golf club, if you guys were writing for Amnesty International, there'd be no political prisoners left in the world, because it's really concerted, and it's really the same message over and over, that some sort of willful damage. Now, I understand that a farrier was there this week, and they said that from what they could gather around the weight of the shoe and blah, 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 I mean, I'm not a Senec expert or anything, you know, that there wasn't a rider involved and it was an accident. So I think it's that thing of being conciliatory, and what seems to, although I know there are really great people at the golf course and lots of volunteers, and the people I know who play golf are lovely, there doesn't seem to be a very conciliatory attitude in this case. And, you know, if it was an accident, someone is potentially going to be prosecuted for willful damage. And it seems that we can't get to the bottom of this because it may not have been willful damage, and yet there seems to be the intention to insist that it was.
Once again, you're quoting individuals. You know, it's my concern is the damage that horses can do to golf courses, and if they're not controlled, if a horse that is not controlled properly is going to head straight for a green, then I feel we have a problem.
Yeah, no, look, I can't disagree with that, and that's I think we need to separate this issue in that it's roaming stock. I think we need to consider that the golf club have removed a kilometre of fencing that surrounds the rear of the park. So it's a little bit difficult in this position to actually cry that this is perhaps an issue with stock on a park in a rural area when you've taken the fences down. But certainly, I mean, I would like to think that if this is a genuine issue, and it appears that it is, that at the time perhaps that the reserve management plan for this reserve is developed, and I genuinely hope that it is for the well-being of the community, that it may be a consideration that such a trail could be fenced. Certainly there's requirements for the council under our District Plan and Reserves Act, and the golf club too, to preserve the wetlands. And one of the concepts that the equestrian communities has been talking about for some years now is if the wetlands are fenced with a wide periphery, there would be enough room within there for the bridle trail to exist. And if anyone would like to go for a walk, you can wander around behind this museum, behind the riding club. There's a bridle trail that runs right around that area, and it's runs through an area that's been fenced to protect the wetland. And this is a realistic, workable solution that could happen through this part of the land, part of the park as well.
So how do you both?
I agree with you, Paul, and you know I agree, because we've sat down with a cup of tea in front of your fire and talked about this concept. And the impression I get is the cost constraints are stopping that happening.
Well, I hear what you're saying, but I disagree. As a member of the local board now, I see that we're spending millions of dollars in this community. I was distressed at the wind-up of the last board under the Auckland City Council. There is a significant fund that had been gifted by a ratepayer in our community who deceased, that was given for fencing of reserves for this specific purpose. And that was just distributed as a wash-up. It was hundreds of thousands of dollars that could have done this job. A significant portion of it, $80,000, was used to seal the road into the sports park. The reality is, with in the absence of planning, as a community, we're getting let down, and it is just not good enough that these two community groups are getting pitched against each other and have been for generations.
Mm. And we need to knock this on the head. So is the solution to get a resource management plan?
Yeah, it's a reserve management plan.
Reserve management plan.
So that's absolutely the solution here. The Minister of Conservation has been involved in this thing because of the contention of this debate that's played out over the last 10 years as we've worked through the district plan process. And the advice of the Minister of Conservation, who governs the Reserves Act, to the Mayor, to our local board, to our Member of Parliament, is that we need a reserve management plan.
And how do you feel about a reserve management plan?
I'm open to it, of course. But, you know, Paul's point of Hagley Park and a few others in New Zealand, that, you know, there's 340-odd golf courses in New Zealand, and there's 340-odd minus a couple that don't have horses on them. You know, and there's, you know, you've got to think, there's got to be a reason. These are things that have to be sorted through.
There is a reason, Graham, and the reason is that the 300 or so minus a couple are on private property. The reality is this is a public recreation reserve that's owned not by the council but by our community, and it's administered by the council for the beneficiaries, which is you and me and our kids and future generations and the entire community.
Can I just ask how many people are members of the golf club? Approximately?
It's around 300 or so.
Mm. Yeah. Look, I mean, personally, I just think I live in a great place and it is an island and space is limited, and it seems to me that whether there were golf clubs or there weren't, or people share space or they don't, we also need to be looking into the future. And it really bothers me that people on the island can't get on, and two groups that do really valuable work for the community that provide so much enjoyment to different people cannot find a way to work together and share the space. And I take your point about fencing the area off, but to be honest, what I loved about walking down there is the fact that I could stop and watch a bit of golf, and I felt as a walker I was really respectful. If someone was teeing off, I was just waiting and for them to, you know, be able to concentrate, and then I was walking on, and it added to things that I could look at when I was going on that walk. And if I'd seen a horse, I would have loved to see a horse.
Well, specifically, and back to Hagley Park, where until recently there was a commercial horse hire business running through this part of the park as well. You know, this was the requirement of the community, that it wasn't fenced. It works really well. But the mechanism that we're missing is not an intent, because you're sitting here listening to Graham and myself both saying that we're happy to sit down and nut this thing out. What we are missing is the council stumping up with the money to provide a reserve management plan. And it's just not good enough. At this point in time, the council is looking to spend the value of money that would pay for a professionally done reserve management plan, which would solve this problem once and for all. And they're looking to spend this building a boardwalk from the back of the cemetery across to the park, an expensive development through this, you know, special wetland that no one has ever asked for. So simply, we knock that project on the head and we reapportion that money which has been budgeted over the next year and put it to a reserve management plan, and then we can actually sit down and have this constructive conversation, not just with the golf club. And I have to say on record here that I'm not opposed to an 18-hole golf course. Let's do the management plan. Let's see what the community wants and what the community needs. But when as a community we're looking at spending millions of dollars developing an 18-hole golf course, when even New Zealand Golf's strategic plan is saying 18-hole golf courses are driving us broke, let's promote 9-hole golf, why the hell are we doing it when we've got other significant investments that we can do in this community, such as swimming pools?
What do you make of that as your last comment?
I hear what you're saying, you know, but it's also the feeling that an 18-hole golf course would provide a tremendous tourist facility, because, you know, this island does thrive on tourism. We feel that an 18-hole golf course would be well received. However, you know, like everything, Paul, you know, we're really prepared to sit down and listen to the facts. I mean, it is a truth that sports are getting shortened. You know, I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, look at sevens rugby, look at 2020 cricket.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people generally don't have the time to play. You know, they want to, if they want, it's a quick fix thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean,
Joe Public here. Mm-hmm. I mean, I take that point as for the tourists, that's a great thing. But, you know, the land is for the community. And there are things that I would like to potentially see, like a swimming pool. And I don't know if that would go into that land. I don't know if it's suitable or anything. But it's, you know,
it was specifically envisaged when it was purchased. It's on the list of recreational needs identified in 1983.
Oh, really? Yeah. So, yeah. Okay, well, the other thing was this notion of reallocating the money for the boardwalk. What did you make of that suggestion?
Well, I think the boardwalk, as Paul does, is a bit of a nonsense because, I mean, the cost of it is astronomical. Mm. And, you know, I mean, I think if there's any money to be spent, it could be spent in a much wiser way that if somebody, you know, if we were to sit down and discuss how...
Rehiring groundsmen, for example.
Yeah, well, this is exactly it. And this has been a really encouraging interview, and I thank you for coming along, Graham. But, you know, what our community can hear here is that these community groups are happy to sit down in a constructive fashion and sort through these issues. We are being denied this opportunity by our council, and that is the problem. It's not a problem between horses and golfers.
So who is supposed to lead this? Are you suggesting that the council sit down and
this is the council's
lead the...
Yeah, this is the council's job. I mean, we've just been through the riding community over the past few years. The regional council reviewed their reserve management plans for their reserves right across the Auckland region, which I note those two of those reserves contain golf courses. It was the most wonderful process. We submitted on a whole raft of things. We didn't get everything that we submitted for. We got knocked back on a whole lot of things with really good reasoning and a nice sit-down conversation around the table with parties. But the difference is at the end of the day, when you've got a plan as a community, you can get stuck in and make it work. And that's what we see in our parks. We don't have any of this contention in our regional park.
Mm. Yeah, but I with all of this, my two reservations are obviously damage to a course, and it's obviously if we can figure out a way to do that. But the danger element scares me too, because believe me, golfers don't have a clue where their ball is going. To hit a horse scares me, especially if it's got a young child on the horse who is unable to control the horse once the horse.
Yeah, but we know from experience, Graham, I mean, you know, I've been riding around there for years, and as have my family and numerous other people. You know, we've crossed paths on the course and on a regular basis with other golfers, and there's a common sense of courtesy. Often the equestrians will sit off to the side of the fairway, out of the way, behind the tree or whatever else, and just sit there, happy to sit and wait for 5 or 10 minutes while a group of golfers play the fairway. And equally, there's always been a willingness by golfers generally to sit, if they can sit and wait while they wait teeing off while the horses cross the path. There is no problem. Those are valid concerns, but there's nothing there that we can't manage if we can just sit down and have the right conversation. And a lot of it will boil down to design, and as we've discussed before with the requirement to fence and protect the wetlands anyway, there's a whole lot of scope there to actually sort this problem out.
All right.
Yeah, lovely. Well, look, thank you both very much for coming in. Graham, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your thoughts on what's been going on. It's been really great.
It's been a great pleasure.
Paul, thank you as well for sharing your ideas. And so we look forward to a reserve management plan and riders and golfers working together for the greater good.
I think there's a bit of ground to make up.
But yeah, there is ground to make. But I sow the seed that throughout the rest of the country, golfing and horse riding go side by side, and there is no different here. Aside that we have been horribly let down over the years. And it's really distressing that we're sitting here paying the price.
Well, I think it's wonderful that there's an example of it already.
Yeah.
And so there's actually, you know, we can see that it's working, and it's just a mindset to think, oh, well, maybe it could work. Why couldn't it work in spite of these things of, oh, you know, maybe there's a danger or whatever. But
one of the positive things about the Super City, Sharon, is that now that we're apart, that all of the councils are together, there's a series of other golf courses, of course, where the horses do exist. And all the staff that manage that and have done that management planning are now employed by the same council that we're administered by. So we have those resources we can access.
Great. Well, listen, thank you both so much for coming in. Have a lovely day. Enjoy the weekend. Are you going to be golfing and riding today? Maybe not.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Not across the golf course, though, Paul.
Oh, cool.
Well, yeah, it was only last week, actually, at the car boot sale. The golfers were trying to sell me a golf trailer that I could extend so I could use it off the horse. But but I am looking forward to one day in the not too distant future being able to play golf on our golf course.
Lovely, yeah. Great. And now we've got Anna Foodie. Anna Schwartz, who is runner-up in the MasterChef competition that finished this week. Hi, Anna. How are you doing?
Hey, great.
Great. So can we call you MasterChef Waiheke?
Sure.
Right, so the secret's out.
The secret is out.
So the
toot toot.
Yeah, the big question that everyone's been asking is, how was it possible to keep a secret for so long? Did you tell your husband?
I did. I told Jeff knew. Well, obviously he knew because it came out at the end to greet me. Right. And my kids knew, and they've been brilliant at keeping a secret. Absolutely so proud of them.
Wow, so that's incredible. Your son here is here today. Hi, Jai.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
Good. So was it hard keeping a secret?
Yes.
Yeah? Did people ask you?
Yeah, a lot of people did.
Yeah? And what did you say?
I said I just can't tell you.
Oh, great. Good job.
Awesome.
That's incredible. Yeah, a child keeping a secret. That's really incredible, Jai. Well done. And so what was it like trying to keep a secret for that long?
Well, I had to tell, you know, a couple of people. So Jeff, my mum knew. I didn't tell my brothers and not my sister, but my best friend. I needed those couple of people just because of what happened. I suppose if I'd won, I may have... I think people might have known. I don't know. I probably couldn't have kept the smile off my face. It was exhausting when I got back from the show as well. And I think just losing that focus was, you know, I felt a little bit down for a while. Not only having lost, but probably how the final kind of went in the end. But that's my little bit of controversy that I've...
Well, I have to say it made really compelling viewing. The final, and I think part of it is that you're on Waiheke, so obviously I enjoyed that side of things. Also, you always strike me as being so composed, and I could see that just the stress on your face in the final. So it was obviously quite a, and people talking to you when you're cooking. What was that like?
Yeah, no good for me especially. I think I definitely got used to it in the end. It was one thing that I knew. I mean, my family don't even come near me when I cook. I mean, you know, I'm that focused.
It's yeah, like, I'm a bit like
get
that.
Out of my kitchen. It was incredibly hard. I mean, I even saw it in the whole sort of progress of the show that I did get more comfortable with that. The final was incredibly stressful and demanding, and
how
just
long did it take?
They weren't very nice. There was no sort of help, or I mean, when I initially got all flustered with the walnuts, I mean, that was funny looking back on that, because that was that classic sort of going, you know, clicking into fourth gear and going so fast that you just miss something so simple.
And you felt they weren't very nice at the time.
No, I just remember thinking that, my gosh, they're just, it's so hard, and they're also being incredibly sort of hard on me as well.
Was that just in the final or just
throughout?
Yeah,
I think, I don't know that whether that was a process of trying to knock me off course, but I believe that I worked incredibly well, especially in the final and throughout. But, I mean, I was really happy with how I actually worked, and I felt like a true chef. You know, getting through those challenges.
One of the were you quite surprised at the way it was? Did you find out new things looking at the cut, or were you quite surprised at the way it was cut together?
Let's just say we probably won't go into that. Let's just say that it would have been great if I'd seen the edited cut before I'd actually seen the final myself. I think there were things that I was slightly concerned about, but. That's behind me now, and my future is my future. So, I'm happy with where I'm at, and by no means will my career be damaged by not winning.
I'm just quite interested in editing anyway, and yes. I thought it was quite interesting just some of the reaction shots that felt that maybe they'd been taken from other parts of the show or had been fitted in to make it seem as though there was
cut
a reaction
and paste.
Yes,
that did happen.
And is it necessary to run I mean, I'm always quite curious about that. Everyone in a reality show, whether they're on The Biggest Loser or MasterChef, they're always running. And I always wonder, is that because they don't give you enough time, or do they just say you've got to run?
I just think you just run because you're panicking. You're given, you know, a certain amount of time. You never know if that's – it just seems like it's so daunting to get through what you need to get through. So I think running is just a big part of maybe, you know, a couple of you know, I don't think I ever fell over on my face or anything, but –
yeah,
definitely ran a lot throughout the whole 16 weeks.
So is the thing that you were alluding to, the time extension, is that what you're saying you didn't want to talk about?
Yeah, we're just not going to go into that anymore. Okay, that's in the past.
Yeah,
I'm happy.
Fine, fair enough. And so were you are you a professional cook to start with, or how did it occur to you to go on to MasterChef?
I suppose foodie is just the best way that I can express my passion for food. And you know, it's strange because I didn't even realize that I was ever going to have a career in food. It was just something I was good at, and that be it, you know. It wasn't really until, I suppose, series two that I started thinking, hey, I can actually do this. And and therefore my passion sort of grew. And I went to see somebody. I was a little bit confused about where I was going with my career, and I think somebody said to me, I know the thing that you're best at is the thing that you're actually, it's sitting there right in front of your face, but you're actually not addressing it. And I couldn't even see it. I mean, it was that far away from my sort of, you know, kind of not reality, but I just wasn't focusing on it. So series two came out. I was pregnant then. There was no way I was going to do that when I was pregnant. But I just said to myself, right, I'm going to apply for Series 3, even though we just had a little baby. I thought, hey, give it a go, see where I get. Will I get interview? Will I get past the interview? Will I get into the first, you know? And it just went and developed from there. And I suppose that's kind of, you know, a meant-to-be kind of thing.
What kind of preparation did you do for it?
So initially we had a written interview that followed on to heading into town. Went to the convention centre, trying to remember where it was. That's we had a sit down proper. It was pretty hardcore, actually, a million questions about food, just so they could see where your skill base was, and then you're given a sort of yes or no. Then we bought our little pack of food, which is our signature dish, and downstairs we went and prepared our signature dish, and we prepared it presented it to the producer and Imagination TV.
And so how many people were producers. Doing that?
So all of us were doing that. Actually, not all of us. Let's think, because then it got knocked down to 50. So it might have been, I'm not really sure, 200.
Oh, seriously, 200 people cooking food.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
And then, so they had us on timetables, strict timetables, times, in and out, you know, kind of thing.
What did you make?
I made my signature dish as a pan-fried snapper with sat on a bed of red quinoa. And on top was a lovely euro.
Sat on a bed of quinoa?
Quinoa.
Oh, quinoa.
Yeah, okay. I say quinoa.
Yeah.
Quinoa?
Oh, whatever. Yeah,
and had lovely Euro Asian salad on top.
Oh, lovely!
So it was a lovely dish that I've sort of made for other people. Sally Ann, I used to make it for Sally Ann actually quite a lot when she was not well, and it's a really lovely, simple, sort of healthy, tasty dish. Yeah. And it's sort of, wow, I got three yeses actually. So then you got yes, okay, you're in, and then you could come back after a week and then present it to, you're on film, you're doing the same thing.
And, oh, the same thing again,
but you're walking
but on film.
Into the judges and you're presenting it to the judges. So it was actually about four auditions before I actually literally sort of became part of the MasterChef Top 50.
Right, okay, yeah. Oh. And so how did that work, the whole talking to camera thing? When were you talking to camera? So you, like, I was just looking, that last show, how long did that last? How long were you in the studio for? Because obviously we see it in an hour and a half, how long did the process
It's over two start? Days. So we had two challenges on one day, then we went home, and then we came back in the next day. But it's pretty much So Rick Stein came in early. I remember that we had to be there sort of 7:30. He was off to Taste Auckland. But they pretty much lasted a 12-hour day. They were grueling.
And then you make your dish and then you talk to camera, or while the thing is going on, you're going
you're
off
always,
and talking
once
to...
You're actually, once the show pretty much episode one started, I mean, you're on camera, you're talking on camera. There's no sort of on and off thing.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mm. Okay. And what was it, you're a mum and you've got three kids. And I have to say, one of the things that I was rooting for you the whole time was just thinking, oh my goodness, you're away from your family for, what was it, 3.5 months in the end?
I think it's 16 weeks, yeah.
Right. Okay. And so how did that process work? I mean...
Well, I mean, I didn't even think I was going to take this, I knew that I was just going to go and see how it went. I remember saying to Jeff, look, if this is not going to work for us, it's fine, I can do it next year, because I knew that. And we were also purchased a piece of land, and we were working on our design for our barn house, so that was also going on in the background. But and I had a 8-month-year-old baby, but I just remember thinking, okay, well, what can we do to help us out? And magically a sort of nanny appeared. And so we knew that could happen, so Jeff could get into town and be at the business and do what he needed to do.
Mm.
So it's kind of like, everything just worked its way through things, and I suppose magically or not magically.
I have to say, I had tears in my eyes when the door opened and the family came through the door.
It was just, what a good little ploy for them to make me just completely,
fall apart.
Yeah. Great. No, it was, yeah. I can't.
But I thought, what if they hadn't been there, you'd have been gutted.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
That would have been worse.
I really thought they were, because at the, I kept asking behind the, the production, do you think they're going to bring the families out?
Yeah.
And they kept saying, oh no, we're not going to do that this year. Oh. And I kept thinking, oh, okay. And I didn't, apparently Sienna came in, they came in a lot earlier with Jeff, and then they told them to go away because my whole station at the final actually blew up.
Oh.
All my electrics, they didn't show that. Was that a ploy? I don't know.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, but random. Anyway, so they got sent back again. Sent away again.
Right.
Anyway, then when they came back, apparently she was screaming, crying, but I didn't hear anything. So how funny is that? Mother's instinct usually.
Yeah.
But man, magic to see them when they came through.
And
the door.
So, what was that like? Not having mum for a few months. Jai, are you still there? What was it like not having mum? Did you feel very brave? Did you really miss her?
Yes. It was
quite tough.
Yeah.
Okay.
I remember Jai saying, I rang him up one day and I said, hi, darling, do you miss your mummy? And he said, Mia does. I said, oh, okay then. And then he said, Mum, I just want you to win.
Oh.
It was very sweet.
That's great. And I would imagine, because I know my daughter always misses me, she misses me more than she misses her father if he's away, whereas my son, it's the other way around.
Yeah, Mia missed me a lot, and I think she wasn't able to express it, but I could tell when I got back. She actually was almost like she was a bit upset with me for a while.
Yes.
Just as kind of she wanted
super
to probably
sulk.
Say. Yeah. Like, you were gone so long.
Yeah.
Never planned to go that long, by the way.
Yeah. That was incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, the other thing is you make it seem as though it's achievable. I mean, I'm sure it's not. But the fact that you got so far and, you're someone we know in the community, you suddenly think, oh, well, maybe I should be getting on to MasterChef, which clearly I shouldn't. But, so it's a huge, huge achievement.
Yeah, it's an amazing feeling I get when I cook, and I suppose that's whatever, however stressed around it, sort of when it comes down to the elemental process of actually getting into the cooking, it's what gets me going. Mm. So even throughout the competition.
Well, I have to say, through the watching you make the laksa, where you seem so confident and you really, clearly knew what you were doing, and it was just like a real joy to watch someone who's really in their element doing something.
Yeah, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, what did you make of the fact that you were, you're a mother of three children going and doing this? How did that match up to other people's experience? Did you feel that it was an advantage, or it worked for you or against you being a slightly older person having lots of family experience?
I think I would say that, most of the contestants were between 24 to early 30s. And then Charlene, of course, was the other mum, my best
mate. Oh, was she a mother as well?
She was 34. And Tony was, I think he's 36 or 37. But I suppose you always have more experience as you get on in life, depending on where you're, like what your field of, you know, what you're passionate about. But I think it had its plus and minuses because I wasn't used to being in that sort of party scene, you know, tribey thing anymore. Family, you know, is where I'm at. So it was really hard sort of being away from home. And then I think, you know, constantly sort of being in competition when you're off camera and in the house and everyone's sort of competing. And it was mentally hard. I just kept saying to myself, it's not a popularity game here. It's just, this is my life. And I didn't really worry about what people were thinking. And I was actually really proud of myself. I just kind of blew the cobwebs out. You know, I didn't seem to. And I kept saying, I can do this. You know, I really can do this. I can win. You know, I kept... It was a very strong conviction,
But I felt you played it with dignity as well. I mean, I think Chelsea even acknowledged the fact you'd been a great contestant to work with.
Yeah.
Because I think that's important. Sometimes you
don't want to get bitchy, do you? Yeah. I mean, I think Jax and Nadia last year didn't get on, and there was a lot of that. But at the end of the day, you know, great people, and she's a really great person. I like her very much. I'm very happy for her. And
would you do it again?
It's hard to say now that I've watched the whole show. It becomes hard because you see how it's all been edited, and a lot of upset feelings around that. But I would definitely say, from the experiences, absolutely one of the best things, because I've learnt and gained so much from it personally, and I'm sure that now I've sort of proved myself. I worked bloody hard for it, but I've proved myself that I can kind of take on these challenges and, you know,
no,
do them
great.
Well.
Yeah. So where to now then?
So where to now?
I mean, imagine you've been waiting for this to sort of play out. I mean, so that you can kind of move on.
Sure, it's great to be here. I've launched my website on Wednesday. That's annaschwartz.co.nz. That's a great website about where I'm at, what I'm offering. It's got a blog attached. I want to just keep cooking, inspiring, doing what I love best, which is making the lovely food. And I would love to do a cookbook one day. I don't think I'll be I'll definitely achieve that. That will happen, I imagine. And just, I'm really interested in doing sort of different stuff. So I would love to do food travel. That would be one of my big desirable things later on. But I've also got a purpose-built kitchen for a cooking school. So I'm really into teaching and inspiring people. Yeah, and children. So that's definitely on the scope. I want to. I know the children are very amazing on this island, and I'm very keen to have some cooking classes with the kids.
Oh wow! I have to say, cooking and kids. I think that's a great skill to be able to pass on.
That's right. Yeah. Yep.
Oh look, well, all the very best, and I hope you can, you know, ride on that, because I think the MasterChef, it was, I mean, regardless of what happened in the final, it was a complete, you know, it was a total victory, and you did so well.
Thank you,
and,
Sharon.
You know, you just came across as being an excellent cook, and I hope it opens up lots of opportunities for you.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
All right. Thank
Lovely.
You very much.
So that's annaschwartz.co.nz for food tips and what Anna's up to.
Great.
Lovely. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to the interviews from Island Life, our weekly look at Waiheke people, events and issues, every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, with interviews repeated on Wednesdays at 7 p.m. and Thursdays at 12:30 p.m. Island Life is brought to you by The Village Butchery, the place to go for great cuts of meat and friendly service. You'll find them at 102 Ocean View Road, Onirawa.